For those of you who are visiting us, we are studying John's Gospel. And this morning we have come to page 49 in the copy of the Gospel that you have in front of you. Page 49, chapter 18 of John's Gospel, verse 28, through to chapter 19, verse 16. They took Jesus from Caiaphas' house to the governor's palace. It was early in the morning. The Jews did not go inside the palace because they wanted to keep themselves ritually clean in order to be able to eat the Passover meal. So Pilate went outside to meet them and said, "What do you accuse this man of?" Their answer was, "We would not have brought him to you if he had not committed a crime." Pilate said to them, "You yourselves take him and try him according to your own law." The Jews replied, "We are not allowed to put anyone to death." This happened to make come true what Jesus had said when he indicated the kind of death he would die. Pilate went back into the palace and called Jesus. "Are you the king of the Jews?" he asked him. Jesus answered, "Does this question come from you, or have others told you about me?" Pilate replied, "Do you think I am a Jew? It was your own people and their chief priests who handed you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom does not belong to this world. If my kingdom belonged to this world, my followers would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. No, my kingdom does not belong here." So Pilate asked him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. I was born and came into the world for this one purpose, to speak about the truth. Whoever belongs to the truth listens to me." "And what is truth?" Pilate asked. Then Pilate went back outside to the Jews and said to them, "I cannot find any reason to condemn him. But according to the custom you have, I always set free a prisoner for you during the Passover. Do you want me to set the king of the Jews free for you?" They answered him with a shout, "No, not him. We want Barabbas." Barabbas was a bandit. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him whipped. The soldiers made a crown of thorny branches and put it on his head. They put a purple robe on him and came to him and said, "Long live the King of the Jews!" And they went up and slapped him. Pilate went back out once more and said to the crowd, "Look, I will bring him out here to you to let you see that I cannot find any reason to condemn him." So Jesus went outside, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Look, here is the man." When the chief priests and the guards saw him, they shouted, "Nail him to the cross! Nail him to the cross!" Pilate said to them, "You take him then and nail him to the cross. I find no reason to condemn him." The Jews answered back, "We have a law that says he ought to die because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard them say this, he was even more afraid. He went back into the palace and said to Jesus, "Where do you come from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me. Remember, I have the authority to set you free and also the authority to have you nailed to the cross." Jesus answered, "You have authority over me only because it was given to you by God. So the man who handed me over to you is guilty of a worse sin." When Pilate heard this, he was all the more anxious to set him free. But the Jews shouted back, "If you set him free, that means you are not the emperor's friend. Anyone who claims to be a king is the emperor's enemy." When Pilate heard these words, he took Jesus outside and sat down on the judge's seat in the place called the stone pavement. In Hebrew, the name is Gabbatha. It was then almost noon of the day before the Passover, and Pilate said to the Jews, "Here is your king." They shouted back, "Kill him! kill him, nail him to the cross. Pilate asked them, do you want me to nail your king to the cross? The chief priest answered, the only king we have is the emperor. Then Pilate handed Jesus over to them to be nailed to the cross. I think I'll read just a little further to the last thing Pilate did. So they took charge of Jesus, and he went out carrying his own cross, came to the place of the skull, as it is called. In Hebrew it is called Golgotha. There they nailed him to the cross. They also nailed two other men to crosses, one on each side, with Jesus between them. Pilate wrote a notice and had it put on the cross. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, is what he wrote. Many Jews read this because the place where Jesus was nailed to the cross was not far from the city. The notice was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. The Jewish chief priest said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather, this man said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written stays written. There are many extraordinary features about the trial of Jesus. It took place at an unusual time. It began in the hours of darkness, early in the morning, a time when very rarely are trials of justice held for obvious reasons. And then it took place in an extraordinary place, or rather two places. The trial is divided, and half of it was held outside a building and half of it inside, so that the judge was literally on the run from one place to the other the whole time. That in itself, we shall see, is deeply significant, because that man was torn not just between two places, but between two possible courses of action. And the very fact that he kept running in and out of the building showed how uncertain he was and how torn between two loyalties. But the reason why the trial was held in two places and not one is itself a dreadful indictment of the depths of hypocrisy to which human religion can sink. The Jews made this necessary by saying, it is the day before the Passover, and if we go into a Gentile building the day before, we might become defiled in God's sight, because there may be a little scrap of unleavened bread in that home, and we shall be ceremonially unclean. We have scruples. We take our religion seriously. We don't want to be defiled in God's sight. And so they pushed Jesus inside. Can you imagine a greater irony than this? That these people, desperately anxious not to have any connection with the little bit of unleavened bread, should be doing to the Son of the very God they sought to please what they were doing. And so they pushed Jesus in, rendering him unclean as a Jew. And then they allowed the uncleanness of all the other malice and hatred in their heart to ruin them. And they pushed Jesus in, and then were defiling themselves with malice and hatred and with all kinds of evil plans against Jesus. And they were unclean in God's sight in a dreadful way. There is a warning here for us all right at the beginning. You can become so over-scrupulous in the outward matters of religion that you overlook much weightier matters. You can be so involved with ritual that you overlook righteousness, so particular about sacraments that you forget sanctification, so anxious to be clean in little respectable ways that you forget the big ways in which God demands you to be clean. This is a danger that all of us must take note of. And the Jews fell right into the trap. They really did. And they pushed Jesus in, and they said, we can't come in because we want to be clean in God's sight. In spite of all that they were doing, that's what they did. Well, we'll pass over that warning and look at the trial. Now, I'm going to go through the trial step by step and just look at what was said, what questions were asked, what answers were given. First of all, we'll divide the trial into five sections. Very simply done. First of all, Pilate and the Jews outside. Second, Pilate and Jesus inside. Third, Pilate and the Jews outside. Fourth, Pilate and Jesus inside. Fifth, Pilate and the Jews outside. Can you remember that? Three outsides and two insides. And I want you to notice the balance. Do you know that if he had stopped at number four, he wouldn't have done what he did? It was because he went outside for the final word. It was because he let the Jews have the last say that Pilate did the wrong thing. Right up to the end of the fourth section, Pilate's thinking was right. But then he took the fatal step and he went outside again. It wasn't that he wasn't trying to be fair. He was listening to both sides. But he tipped the balance on the wrong side, and he listened just once too often to the people outside. We'll see how this happens. Let's take the first section. Pilate and the Jews outside the building. He was probably in a bad mood, having to get up this early and having to start a trial this early. And he'd had a bad night, his wife had been dreaming, and he was probably irritable. But he came out to the Jews and he said, "Now, first let's get it clear. What crime are you charging this man with?" Now, that is a right and proper way to begin a trial. He was doing exactly what he ought to do thus far. He was beginning by a simple question: what is the crime? And then he would try that as judge. It was a legal routine. A formal complaint had to be lodged before the trial could take place. The Jews give an extraordinary answer. If he hadn't committed a crime, do you think we'd bother to bring him to you? Now, that was virtually saying, we are not wanting the trial to take place. We don't want you to hold a trial. We don't want you to reopen the trial. It's all over and done with. It's settled. We've just come to you for the sentence, not the trial. So, Pilate, we are not asking you to try this man. Therefore, we don't need to go into the trial and the charge and the crime. So Pilate, a little piqued by this, replied somewhat to this effect: "Well, if you won't let me share the trial, I'm not going to share the sentencing. If you don't have me in at the beginning, I'm not coming in at the end. You take him and see the thing right through from start to finish according to your own law. If you've tried him by your own law, then see the whole process through." And again, he was perfectly right to say this. For a Roman representative of justice should never cause a man to be sentenced without trying him. He must not accept anybody else's word, innocent or guilty. So he was doing exactly the right thing. The Jews reply, "We can't put him to death. You know that, Pilate. You have kept to the Romans the right for capital punishment." Now, that was sheer hypocrisy, because they didn't mind stoning anyone if they could get away with it. They'd already tried to stone Jesus on at least three occasions. They were going to stone Stephen within a few weeks. The simple fact was that at the time of the Passover, the Roman governor was in Jerusalem, crowds of Galileans were in Jerusalem, and to stone Jesus publicly, to do it with their hands, would have been extremely risky. And they saw a golden opportunity to get the Romans to do their dirty work for them. And then they could wash their hands and say, "You can see he's a civil criminal. Even the Romans see that he's a bad man." It would have discredited as well as destroyed Jesus in the sight of the multitude. And the Galileans, who were for Jesus, would not have dared to rise up against the Romans if they did it. So you can see why they wanted the Romans to kill. It wasn't because they were being dutiful citizens. "We can't put him to death. It's the Roman law." They put plenty of people to death if they wanted to. It was a glorious opportunity to blame the Romans and get them to do their dirty work. "We can't impose the death penalty." Now, there's a little bit in brackets here that John adds, that Jesus had known all along that he would never die by stoning. The Jews would kill him, but he would not die by stoning. And he'd predicted all along that the Son of Man would be lifted up, as the serpent was lifted up on the pole in the wilderness by Moses. He'd predicted all along that he would be crucified. And John just points out that the Jews actually fulfilled to the letter Jesus' own predictions about his own death, by insisting that the Romans did it. Now, so far, Pilate was absolutely fair, absolutely right. He did the right thing all the way along. So what is he to do? He decides to go back into his palace and open the trial again. And once again we see Pilate as a representative of justice doing what he should do. Back inside, here is Jesus standing in the dock, and Pilate says, we're going to reopen the trial. The only crime that is deserving of capital punishment is insurrection. Are you a rebel leader? Are you starting a nationalist movement that will fight against the Romans? Are you the king of the Jews? Because the word king is the key word right through this trial. Are you going to rise up and try and get the throne for yourself? And that's the first question he asks. Now the interesting thing is that the Romans were quite happy with a puppet king whom they had appointed. They were not happy with a man who sprang up from the populace claiming to be king. They didn't mind appointing a king Herod, who was in their hands anyway. But when a new man comes up and says, I'm king, then they got worried. So he says, are you one of these kings? Are you going to try and take the throne? Is that what you're after? Is that why they've brought you to me? And Jesus, who often answered a question with another question, just lobbed the ball back into someone else's court, said, who told you to ask me that? You're really thinking that up in your own heart? Or did those outside tell you to ask me? Of course, the ones outside had said, he says he's the king of the Jews. But the important thing that Jesus is pointing out is this. He's appealing to the conscience of Pilate by saying this. If you have evidence against me as trying to claim a throne, then you are perfectly in order to ask me a leading question like that. But if you have no evidence yourself, and this is only hearsay, you have no right to be asking me. Jesus is pleading for justice. He's saying, Pilate, do I have to teach you your job? A judge should not ask the accused, have you done this? The judge ought to listen to the evidence and ought to have evidence before he asks the question. So Jesus says, Pilate, are you saying this from evidence you've got? Do you have a case against me? Or are you just repeating what they've said to you outside? And Pilate had to admit that it was a second-hand question. And he was rather annoyed to be found out, so he gave a rough answer and admitted that he'd been put up to it. He said, I'm not a Jew, it's your people, it's your priests out there, they're saying it. And you can almost see him trying to get out of the blunder that he's just made as a judge through asking a second-hand question. So Pilate now asks another question. Look, I'm trying to help you. Let's start from scratch. What have you been doing? What have you been up to? What have you done? That again is an extraordinary question to ask someone who's been arrested. You tell us what you've been doing. You should tell the prisoner what he's arrested for. You have been doing this. But Pilate says, look, we've got to get some kind of a case. You tell me some crime you've committed and then we can keep everybody happy. What have you been doing to have them all outside like that, passing you over to me? And Jesus, with wonderful calm, says, look, I'm not fighting for a kingdom. If I was after the kind of kingdom you Romans like, I would have fighters. I wouldn't have been arrested. I'd have had enough fighters behind me to stop me even being arrested. My sort of kingdom doesn't belong to this world. It's not this kind of kingdom. Just a simple, quiet statement like that. In other words, Pilate, you've nothing to worry about from me. I'm not going to try and take the throne from you Romans. I'm not going to fight any of you. No need for you to be afraid of little me. That's really what he's saying. Very gently. There are two wrong deductions that have been made from Jesus' statement, my kingdom is not of this world, else would my servants fight. One is that, therefore, Christians ought to be pacifists. Now, it is a wrong deduction for the simple reason that Christians are citizens of two kingdoms, according to the New Testament. They are citizens of an earthly kingdom and of a heavenly kingdom, and they have duties to both. Jesus is only speaking here of the heavenly kingdom. He admits quite freely that an earthly kingdom has to maintain itself by the use of force. and that the rest of the New Testament acknowledges. The famous Pax Romana, the Roman peace, was maintained by the soldiers, who are commended in the scripture for doing their duty and maintaining peace. So that we mustn't judge this statement in that light. Another wrong deduction that has been made is that the Christian is not to have anything to do with the kingdoms of this world once he belongs to the kingdom of Christ. But that's not true either. I've said already the Christian belongs to two. I'm a double citizen. I have a passport to prove that I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom. I have the witness of the Spirit to prove I'm a citizen of the heavenly kingdom. But I have duties to both. That's part of the difficulty of working it all out in facing social and political and international issues. But I've got to try and work it out. But Jesus is saying, I haven't come to establish a new earthly kingdom. I'm not trying to carve a bit of land out on the map so that it can be labeled Jesus' kingdom or something like this. I'm not after that kind of kingdom at all, so you don't need to be afraid. And Pilate, with very quick perception, says, kingdom, kingdom. You are a king then. You've used the word kingdom. You must be some kind of a king. You are a king, are you? What kind of a king are you? And Jesus says, you called me a king. I didn't use the word. I don't want to use that title. It'll be misunderstood. You wouldn't understand me if I did use it. You say so. I'm not saying so. If I say so, you can say, ah, he's a political rebel, so I'm not saying so. You say so. It's on your lips. You see how the conversation unfolds? And then Jesus says, I'll tell you why I've come. My only weapon that I ever use is the truth. I've only come to tell the truth. That's all I'm going to fight with, the truth. I'll establish my kingdom not with a sword, but with the truth. And I came for this end, to tell the truth. And whoever is really interested in truth will be interested in me. Whoever really wants the truth will listen to me. I've come to bear witness to the truth. Truth, truth, the word keeps coming out. Get off this word King Pilate. Get onto the word truth. You as a judge ought to be concerned with truth, with the truth. Are you concerned with truth? You see the impact of this on the judge. And Pilate cynically said, what is truth? We know it's cynical because he didn't even wait for an answer. He turned around and went straight out to the outside again. What is truth? Shall I tell you why he said that? Because Pilate was a Roman, not a Greek. It's the Greeks who studied truth, who thought about it, who debated it, who discussed it. It's the Greeks who explored the realms of philosophy and thought, but the Romans, they were practical. They only wanted to know what worked. Not unlike a lot of people today. Not interested in abstract discussion of what is true, but only interested in practical things, what works. And so when Pilate heard this man talking about truth, he realized he is another philosopher. He is another thinker. He is another debater. I don't need to spend any longer on this man. He's off in these realms of airy-fairy truth. Let these Greek philosophers have their sway. Let them discuss it. I'm a Roman. I'm only concerned. A man who's nattering about truth is no danger to Rome. So he says, what is truth? And you know, the answer was standing 6 feet in front of him. It was the nearest Pilate ever got to the truth in his whole life. Jesus said, I am the truth. If you want to know what's true about men, come to me. If you want to know what's true about God, come to me. If you want to know the truth about this universe, come to me. If you want to know the truth, I am the truth. And Pilate said, what is truth? That's the wrong question. I was reading yesterday of a famous American lady who was dying, and as she died, she said, what is the answer? And then there was silence, and nobody said anything to her. So a few minutes later, she said, what is the question? What is the question? And Pilate said, what is truth? And Jesus said, I am the truth. And you can be within 6 feet of the truth and miss it, because you're cynical. Because you're only interested in down-to-earth practical matters. Because you're more concerned about what's happening in the immediate moment, and you want to get that settled and get back to your breakfast. And you can miss truth, and you can be within 6 feet of it. And Jesus was standing there and said, I came to bring the truth. And Pilate said, oh, truth. And he went out again, and he missed it. I believe that every human life has a moment of truth, at least one. A moment when you're within reach of the truth about yourself and about the future. And you know, you can brush it off as easily as Pilate did with a cynical remark or a question. And you can go your way. And you're back into the busy round of daily life. And you've missed the truth. Well, I mustn't say too much about this. Let's move on. Pilate was now clear in his own mind, absolutely clear, that there was nothing to be afraid of with Jesus. He posed no threat to Rome. There was no crime. The sooner he dealt with this, the better. So out he went. And it was at this second visit to the Jews outside, after the first talk with Jesus, that Pilate began to weaken. It's a very sad thing to see a man take the first step on the slippery slope of cowardice and compromise. But when he went out again, thinking that he would tell them, there's nothing here to make a case of, the weakness began to show. Shall I tell you how? Pilate said, I can't condemn him, he's innocent. And then he made his fatal mistake. He said something like this, if I expand it, you'll understand it. He said, you say he's guilty, I say he's innocent. You think he's guilty, I think he's innocent. There's one way in which we could all act, and you would be happy and I'd be happy. You could go on thinking he was guilty, and I could go on thinking he was innocent. It is the custom at the feast for me to release to you a political prisoner. And in that way, you see him as guilty, and I could see him as innocent. In that way, I've released him, so my conscience is clear, but you can always regard him as a released prisoner, so you can always regard him as guilty. Now, wasn't that a clever suggestion? Keep everybody happy. And then for the rest of his life, he could be labeled as guilty. After all, he was a prisoner, even if he was released. He was a guilty criminal, and the label would stick for the rest of his life. It was a very subtle and clever suggestion. What Pilate should have done to do the right thing would have been to release Jesus on the spot, get him out of the back door of his palace and away, but release him on the spot. But to make a show of it and to release him as a political prisoner was to allow the label innocent to be fastened by Pilate on Jesus and guilty to be fastened by the crowd. Brilliant. Pilate was an astute man. And he was one of those who loved to keep everybody happy, and it was a brilliant compromise. The only snag was that they then said, good idea to have a prisoner released, how about Barabbas? And the whole compromise collapsed. Barabbas, I'm not going to say much about him, except to say something about his name. What an interesting name. Do you know what his first name was? I nearly said his Christian name. But do you know what his first name was? Jesus. Jesus Barabbas. We're told that in another gospel. They both had the same name. Maybe that's why the crowd thought of this other Jesus. And Barabbas means son of the father. Bar means son of, and Abbas, Abba, means father. And so this man's name, this criminal's name, this bandit, this fighter, this violent man guilty of assault, his name was Jesus, son of the father. And the crowd shouted, let's have Jesus, son of the father. Again, what an irony of history. It's incredible how fact is stranger than fiction. If a writer invented such a coincidence, he'd be laughed out of court for being unrealistic. But Jesus, son of the Father, was who they shouted for instead. And so Pilate had to give them Barabbas. What did Pilate do then? Clearly the first compromise had not worked. So he thought of another. He said, I know, it's because I would be letting him go without any punishment. So I will punish him and let him go. And that'll keep us all happy. It'll keep my conscience happy because I've let him go. It'll keep their conscience happy because I've punished him. He said, take Jesus out and flog him. Do you see the downward track? Each compromise did something worse. Each step he now took The truth suffered in the person of Jesus. And since Jesus is truth, whenever the truth suffers, Jesus suffers. So Jesus began to suffer. I'm not going to play on the physical sufferings of Jesus. This was the first part of them. But I'm going to tell you that flogging was flogging. It was a whip with a long leather thong with pieces of bone fastened to the thong all the way down. And a man was flogged until he either went mad or died or was just unconscious with his back flayed to ribbons. It is a dreadful punishment. And Pilate allowed Jesus to be flogged even though he knew he was innocent. Do you know, in the whole of the Old Testament, there is not a single case of an animal that was to be sacrificed and to give its blood for sin. There was not a single case of the animal being tortured beforehand. Not one. It was the Lamb of God who was tortured before he was sacrificed. So Pilate had him flogged, and the soldiers had freedom to do anything they liked with a prisoner they flogged. And they pulled his clothes off him, and they dressed him up, and they made fun of him. They stood him up on a table and said, "Long live the king," and they spat on him, and they slapped his face. And then Pilate brought him out and said, "Look at him. Look at him. Now you're satisfied. Now can I let him go free? Now we're all happy. You've seen him punished, and I can let him go free. All right now, is that a sufficient compromise for you?" Can you see how Pilate's mind was working? He's still trying to find a way to please everybody. And one of the lessons written across this page of Holy Writ is that you will never find a way to please everybody. Never. And if you do, it's Christ who suffers. And the Jews shouted out, "More blood, more blood, more blood. Crucify him. That's not enough. Nail him to the cross. Crucify him." They wanted the extreme penalty, and they'd got it all planned. So Pilate finally said, "You crucify him. I know you're not allowed to, but I'll overlook it this once. I'll stretch the law for you. I can't do it, but you crucify him, and I won't say anything. I won't bring you to court afterwards for breaking the Roman law. Take him away. You do it." That's even worse, isn't it? He's going down and down and down, still trying to keep his own hands clean, and he can't do it. He said, "I just can't find any reason for death." And then at last the Jews came out with the real reason. It wasn't political, it was religious. They said, "Look, Pilate, there is a reason. We haven't told it to you before now, but let's tell you. Do you know that this man says he's the Son of God? And by our law, he deserves to die. That's the reason." And you know, that put the wind up Pilate. Pilate, like most Romans, while he was very practical, combined practical interests with superstition. The Romans were very superstitious. And you'll find still today, you know, that people who don't listen to the gospel, who won't listen to the truth, who say, "Oh, it's all airy-fairy, I'm not religious," you ask them how they are and they say, "Very well, touch wood." You'll find that there is an extraordinary link between these practically minded people who won't have anything to do with religion and sheer superstition. And Pilate was superstitious. "Son of God, I'm out of my depth. I'm dabbling in things I don't understand." And it said he was afraid. Now, what was he afraid of? Was he afraid of the Jews because these religious matters really got them worked up and excited? No. He was now afraid of Jesus. You see, just suppose he was dabbling in something that was beyond his power. Just suppose there was something in Jesus that was more than human. Just suppose. And he was afraid. He was feeling the trap closing on him now. He wanted to please men, and yet now he was beginning to be afraid of the gods. And Romans were afraid of the gods. They used to erect all kinds of statues to them whenever they could. It was time to go back in. So we come to the fourth. Out to the Jews, into Jesus for the first conversation. Out to the Jews to try and get a compromise. Failing. He's in now, a man who's got terror in his heart. He's afraid now. Back into Jesus for the second conversation. And the first question, "Where are you from? What kind of person are you? Where'd you come from? Are you just a man? Could you have come from the gods? Where did you come from? And Jesus said not a word. I find this one of the most puzzling things. I can only give you a few possible reasons that occur to me and leave you to choose. Why did Jesus not reply? Well, would Pilate have understood? Would it have played on Pilate's fears and superstition? Jesus wasn't one to do that with people. Or would it be this reason, and I give it to you for what it's worth, I think it's the one I would incline to. If Jesus had answered that question, he would have escaped the cross so easily. Do you see that? If Pilate had got the idea that he might be the Son of God, Jesus would never have gone to the cross. And I think in that moment there was a little temptation to Jesus to take a way out. And if he'd answered, he would never have been nailed to the cross, and it was God's will. I leave that with you. It's the only explanation I can find that really covers the case. But Pilate was annoyed that he didn't answer. He said, "Now look, man, I'm trying to help you. And I'm really asking you to try and help me. Can't you see the dilemma we're both in? Look, just help me out. I'm trying to get through. I'm trying to help you. And don't you realize that in not answering me, you're leaving yourself in my hands, and I can do anything with you. I can set you free. I can kill you. I've got power over you. Answer me." And Jesus quietly said, "You have no power unless God gave it to you. No man on earth can do anything except God allows him to. And you could have no power over me unless God was willing it. So your power is limited, Pilate. And therefore your guilt is limited." And Jesus shows himself a true judge, a fair judge. Isn't it interesting that all this time Jesus is judging others fairly? And he says, "Pilate, you have got guilt, but not as much as that man outside who pushed me in here. You're guilty, not as guilty as he is, because your power is limited by God." The calm of Jesus just stands out, you know. And Pilate, what could he do? Now Pilate realized he was guilty. That already he'd compromised, that already there was innocent blood on his hands from Jesus' back, and if he wasn't careful, there'd be more blood on his hands. And Pilate was already feeling that he was in the dock. And Pilate was clear in his mind that he must get out of this situation. Now, that's stage four. And still, to this point, Pilate could have got out of it. He'd had two conversations with the Jews outside and two with Jesus. If he'd only let Jesus have the last word, but he didn't. He went out again and he took the last fatal step and let the Jews have the last word. It says he was all the more anxious to set him free, so the Jews used a nasty bit of blackmail and they said, "Pilate, you are not the emperor's friend if you let this man go. He's an enemy. We'll report you. We'll send a complaint to the emperor that you've not been loyal or patriotic." Now that was really hitting Pilate on a most sensitive point, because he had got where he was because of the emperor's favor, and that could easily be lost. It was a very delicate situation. Pilate was the only man in the Roman Empire who had been born as a slave and who rose to be a governor. He had traveled further up the ladder of human ambition than any other man in the Roman Empire. And he knew that if you climb quickly, you can fall quickly. And they said, "Your position will be in jeopardy, Pilate. We're not having this." So Pilate brought Jesus out and said, "Here is your king. I think he's a king. He's got royalty about him in my eyes. Here is your king." And they shouted, they shrieked now. It was mob hysteria. All the crowd that had gathered, and it had grown through these hours. It must have taken a few hours, this trial. The crowd had grown, and now they were just shrieking for the blood of this man. "Crucify him, to the death. Pilate asked his last question. Do you really want me to crucify your king? Is that what you want? Do you notice the word want? When a public servant, a public ruler, a representative of justice asks the public what they want, he's finished as a leader. Absolutely finished. And one of the punishments God allows a nation to suffer is to be ruled over by people who are only concerned with what the people want than with what is right and true. And that can happen to any nation. And Pilate said, is that what you really want? And he sealed the fate of Jesus and his own when he asked that question. And they said, that is what we want. And if you do this, then we'll be loyal to you. We have no king but the emperor. What a lie. They'd wanted a king for centuries. They'd lost king after king. They wanted a king desperately. But this was the last trump card they played, to offer political loyalty to Pilate if he did it. They'd said it negatively. If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Now they say it positively. If you crucify this man, we'll be Caesar's friends. And that was their trump card, and they put it down. And Pilate listened. Said, here he is. Here he is. And he handed Jesus over to them to crucify him. One final gesture he made half an hour later. They came, the regimental sergeant major, the centurion, he came and said, we need a label to go on the cross for his crime. What shall we write? And Pilate said, write, this is the King of the Jews. Write that. Put that on his cross. And the Jews came and said, but don't put that. That'll upset a lot of people. Everybody will read it. Say he said this. That's his crime, that he said it. But Pilate by now had come to the conclusion that his real crime was that he was the king. And in one last sort of gesture, a futile gesture, but in one last independent act to show that he wasn't completely their tool, Pilate said, I've written that and it stays written. And so Pilate's gone down into history. We'll just look at his personality for a few moments after the choir has relived this trial for us by singing to us.
Jesus.
There are only two human beings mentioned in the Christian creeds. The woman who brought Jesus into the world and the man who sent him out of the world. And everywhere the Christian faith has gone, the name of Pontius Pilate has gone down into history. What was wrong with this man? We look just briefly at his past, his present, and his future. The key to a man's behavior at a time of crisis lies in his past, what he has been up to that moment. And Pontius Pilate, beginning life as a slave, rose astonishingly to the level of governor, and that was quite a climb. He did it by fawning on those in higher office and by gaining favors and by being ruthless to those beneath him. He was an ambitious man, and the result of his rapid climb was that he made blunder after blunder. When they sent him to the most notoriously difficult part of the Roman Empire as a governor, namely Israel, to deal with those difficult and funny people, the Jews, he went determined to show the Roman emperor what he could do with difficult people. He arrived in Jerusalem and marched straight into their temple and erected the Roman standard with the Roman eagle on it and a bust of himself in the place of honor, not even stopping to inquire what they thought about graven images. It started a riot, which he put down at the cost of hundreds of lives. A few years later, he had a desire to improve the water supply in Jerusalem, and he built an aqueduct, which you can see to this very day, from the pools of Hebron, far to the south, down the hills to Jerusalem. He hadn't got the money to do it, so without consulting a soul, he borrowed the resources of the temple treasury, money that had been given to God. Once again, there was a riot, and the blood of Galileans mingled with the sacrifices. It's referred to by Jesus, that disaster. Here was a man who, in rushing up the ladder, had committed blunder after blunder. And his great ambition was to get even further up. And he had got there by sacrificing principle to expediency. He never asked what was right, but what would help him up the ladder. So he's not so unusual. There are many who have taken exactly the same line within their own sphere, and you can do it even if you're a big fish in a little pond. If you're a foreman in a little workshop with three or four under you, you can do exactly what Pilate did. And so we come to this present crisis, which was the greatest test of his career and of his character. And at the crucial point, he failed. It was through cowardice that he gave way to compromise. He knew what was right to do, but he was afraid to do it. The reason he was afraid to do it was because of public pressure and therefore the threat to his position, which again is a pressure that all of us have felt in some degree or another. The pressure of what others think about us and what they can do to us is a pressure that is only too real. And so Pilate let the Jews have the last word. That was the one fatal mistake, that in listening to the Lord on the one hand, who quietly told him what was right and true, he listened once too often to those who were demanding something that was not right. And you can see how he fell. It is exactly the same way in which we fall, subject to the same pressure, coming to the same crisis, when we know what is right and we just don't do it because we listen to others three times as against listening to the Lord twice. So before we rule Pontius Pilate out of our ken as a man who was beyond redemption and as a man who was so dreadfully depraved that he could do this thing, let's just look into Pontius Pilate's heart as into a mirror and see a very ordinary human being trapped between right and popularity. What about his future? We know what happened to Pilate. He'd sacrificed Jesus for his career, but he lost his career just a year or two later through another blunder. He was banished. He became unpopular with the emperor. He was sent into exile. And he and his wife lived a lonely life in exile from their home country. Many times they must have sat together, miserable, all alone, and said, "Where did we go wrong? What happened to our career?" And I'm sure the wife would say, "It was that man Jesus. I dreamt about that man. I dreamt that if you did anything to that man, we were finished. And this is what has happened." They died in utter obscurity. And in all the Roman records we have, there is no mention of Pontius Pilate. There was no proof that he even existed. For centuries, some people even said that his name was an invention of the Bible writers. It was only in 1928 that a stone was unearthed at Caesarea, which I've seen with my own eyes, and engraved on the stone was Pontius Pilatus. It was the first proof that we had from the world that Pontius Pilate ever existed. And yet he's known wherever Christ is known. And his name has gone right down through history as a man who, when he came to the crisis, failed. It's not the end of the story, because one day Pilate will rise from his grave. Nobody knows where his grave is, but one day he'll rise from it. And one day he'll stand before a true and a fair judge. That judge will have to say, "Pilate, you were not as guilty as Caiaphas of my death, but you were guilty." And he will be sentenced by the Lord Jesus Christ. That is the personality of Pilate. It's a serious study we've had this morning. We've looked into our own hearts. We've seen the weakness of which human nature is capable. But let me finish by just speaking for 2 to 3 minutes about the other person. Jesus. The key word in this passage, I've said, is the word king. And if ever you see a king, you see a king in Jesus here. Notice his docility. Notice how he submits to being whipped, stripped, slapped, mocked, delivered, crucified. And this is the Son of God, with 12,000 angels waiting to do whatever he told them. And he submits. Think of his humility. There is no self-assertion, no aggressive response to his attackers, just a quietness of spirit. Doesn't even try to defend himself. His dignity strikes me. He strides through this scene as a king. The sheer dignity of royalty is upon him. Of all the people, he is the dignified one. The others are degraded. They act like beasts, but he's dignified. I think of his integrity. No wrong word escaped his lips. A concern for the truth is apparent in every sentence he uttered. His integrity. I see his authority. He is telling his judge, "You are guilty." What authority? And the picture that emerges is that of not only the King of the Jews, but the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. What a coronation. What a coronation for a throne, a beam of wood. For a crown, a bit of hedge. For robes, nothing. For a bodyguard, soldiers gambling. For a scepter, crude nails in his hands. What a coronation. But this is the king. And Pilate came face to face with the King of Kings, but never bowed the knee to him. The question that Pilate had to cope with was the question that every single person listening to my voice now has to cope with. What will you do with Jesus?